Welcome to The Great Security Debate. This show has experts taking sides to help broaden understanding of a topic. Therefore, it's safe to say that the views expressed are not necessarily those of the people we work with or for. Heck, they may not even represent our own views as we take a position for the sake of the debate. Our website is greatsecuritydebate.net, and you can contact us via email at feedback@greatsecuritydebate.net or on Twitter @securitydebate. Now, let's join the debate already in progress.
But I hate to say that because, like, I was reading another article from a gentleman in security, and he said, what you were talking about just now, Dan, how do you separate this? Like, the security teams and the IT teams are the busiest people at home right now trying to keep companies going, where there's some people that just aren't doing anything. There's sales guys that are just sitting there because, you know, even some of my automotive friends, like, what am I doing? All programs have been delayed. You know, I can submit a quote for a door frame, but I'm not being asked to. Like,
right.
There's not a project. Everything's been put on hold, where all these guys on the IT side not only are busier, but you change the landscape, you change how threat actors are working. They're just going to change a technique or a tactic over here to get in this way, and you're constantly moving pieces, right? I just find it really interesting because they wrote the article and just said, I've been busier than I've ever been, but I've had to give myself Saturdays with family and cut myself off from sending emails at night. And I'm reading that, I'm like, I need to start doing that too. You know,
it can encompass your life and work, you know, even for people who have worked remotely, this is a whole new thing. It's a very different thing. A friend of mine at actually one of the guys who, he's in another security group that I'm part of out in Colorado. He wrote a good piece on for Educause, which is one of the big technology and just consortiums for higher ed. And there's a great security community there. He wrote a piece that was, you know, working from home. This is not working from home. This is working from pandemic, and just really highlighted how different it is than your average work from home. I can't go to a coffee shop and go get out of here. I can't, you know, it's just so very encompassing. I'll send you guys a link to it a little bit later. It's a really good piece. It doesn't just apply to higher ed.
Yeah, please do share that.
I will.
You know, I've been having my kids watch the Wiser videos.
Nice.
But I love what they're doing. I told Kelly all about it, and I was, when I would explain it, so it's free. I'm like, you can go on there and look up tons of different stuff. I go, there's videos. I go, this is what some of the school systems should be pulling in, you know, as a easy way to explain to children this style, this informative little video. Because I can sit and watch those as they sketch together, because it builds out in front of you, right?
Yeah.
It's like a presentation done right, where like the animation's in there and it keeps you watching, right? Rather than just a slide that comes up, everything's on there and you're reading it while someone's talking. You're not even listening over here. I think they do a good job with it.
Yeah, they do a great job.
Yeah, kind of thinking about your story, Brian, and what you're talking about on the way the tool was tested, really, I think gets to the heart of that there's still a misunderstanding of what information security is and where we should be focusing. And I think so much of what we do is all predicated on, I'll call them dated control frameworks. You know, you look at a lot of the controls say, well, thou must have antivirus. Thou must do a daily scan. Well, we've kind of moved past that. We have better controls. You know, you're talking about EDR and those things that are real-time watching what's going on. But I think we still have a lot of companies out there to the testing thing that, well, I'm just going to run a couple of adware, a couple of pieces of malware I downloaded against it, which gets back to where we once were, that it's all focused on signatures. So it's only about what we know at the given time. And can you catch what most people know? And that doesn't get ignored.
In addition to a clenching fear of releasing something inappropriately while doing testing.
Right.
Yeah. But this goes also back to the pandemic. I mean, a flu shot looks at signatures, basically.
Yep.
It can only prevent, or hopefully prevent, a known strand of flu. But if you had a like in what we say EDR, if there was a tool that you could use that would go in and look at the behavior of the flu, right? So COVID wasn't a flu, like the RNA strand on this is much longer than that you'd see in the flu. And that's why the flu can change and mutate each year, be multiple different flus. This strain, when people say, oh, there's already a new COVID out there, or it's already mutated, I haven't seen that from one researcher that can actually pinpoint and say that this has changed. The RNA strand on this thing is so long that it would be very, very, very difficult to change. But going to the flu aspect, if you had something that actually acted on the behavior of the flu, so it gets in you, this happens, elevated temperature, I'm beginning to throw up, and then boom, remediate back to being good. That's what everybody wants, right? Right. That's the idea of looking at an AV versus an EDR. Instead of looking at the known strain, look at the behavior of the flu and seeing if you can stop that.
Well, I think it also, it gets back to, and I know you like to quote Art of War and knowing your enemy, right? Understanding, I think really taking a step back and going, what are we really concerned about? And until you know who you're looking for, what they can do, you can't protect anything. Right. I think there's still this old school idea that you see in the movies that, oh, well, it's somebody in their parents' basement wearing a black hoodie that's just doing it. No, it's much more sophisticated than that. I mean, you can buy a full malware suite now online, black market or the dark web, right? For minimal amounts of money. And it comes with support. It comes with support like you would get with Microsoft, Adobe, all of your big package items that you can call up. Hey, I'm trying to attack this person. It's not really working. It's not making the connection. Oh, you just change these strings. And now you've got a working attack. That there's the technical barrier to entry into attacks is so much lower than it ever once was.
Well, when I pay $500,000 or $1 million for something, I expect good support.
Right.
I sense some undertones there. I love that you went to the Art of War, because that's also how I came up with my conspiracy theory. Because if you look at the idea of know your enemy and how can you defeat them without actually firing a shot, right? Well, if I buy all their defenses, if I buy the pawns that they have out at the front line, rather than having to send mine to go kill all of them, I now know all the back doors and I just come in underneath the castle. We'll go ahead and do this. And we never even had to fire a shot. Like,
right.
That was part of my thinking on that. And then I love how you threw out the support side of it. Imagine that. So like a company like Microsoft, right, doing security. And I never say this in meetings, but if you're buying the entire suite, the entire package, right, and now you're buying the security tool as well, they have a few setups of different support teams, but you still go through support, right? It's a very big company. And when you're at war or fighting, it's like, listen, I need the support team that handles the big issues when I'm at war. Like, can I get someone on the phone that can handle this? And when you pay that much money, right, Dan, when you just said, well, if I paid $1 million, I expect really good support. The guys on the underground, these guys know that people will continuously buy and talk if they give really good support. Like, hey, I have an issue. I need my payload to drop right now. Okay. Payload dropping. Boom.
Right.
Yeah. But now you take the flip side of this and you look at standard support mechanisms, you know, look at ITIL. I don't know to what extent any of you have dealt with ITIL, but it's the IT information library. It's the mechanism for setting up good support in an organization, support and operations. And it's, you know, the notion that all of your support comes to one place. All your questions come to one place and they are the broker, they're the experts to get them to the right place. You get good metrics, good analytics, good understanding. You start to see where clusters of incidents happen to be able to identify problems and manage them all the way through. Whereas, and that is, you know, that works in enterprise, but the way that the attackers are handling this is, nah, come to one place, we'll get it taken care of. We've seen this in the publishing world, places like Sci-Hub, where they are, you know, Sci-Hub is an illegal repository of scholarly works, and it's hosted out in Kazakhstan, and it overcomes all the limitations of copyright, all the limitations of fiefdoms, and basically gives you the world's easiest way to search for any scholarly document. You get it in one click, and there's no fuss, no muss, and you get what you want. So people are really intrigued and attracted to using it, not necessarily because they don't already pay to get the content, but because the UX is so good. And so going, you know, good support wins, you know, wins the day.
It's true. Yeah. It's, but at the same time, you know, I'll play the counter argument. You know, we can't snap back the other way when we're talking about the different adversaries and say, well, everything comes back to the big four. It's China, Russia, North Korea, Iran, right? While those four play in a lot of some of the greatest APT attacks, whatever, you know, whatever terminology you want to use, they're not out to get everyone. They are very targeted. And if you break down in each one of the four, they each have their own kind of the indicators of attack that they're using. It's usually the same playbook that they're playing out, and there's certain industries they're going after. And it's key understanding the mapping of each one of those four back to your business and understanding, is that really a threat? Is that somebody we should be concerned about? And we've had this conversation at board levels and kind of going through it and identifying, talk through the four on which ones are we concerned about and the ones that we're not, here's why.
And for the vast majority of people, you're not that interesting.
Right.
No offense, but you're not that interesting to those targets. So you need to be protecting yourself against the every target, the easy, you know,
the ankle cyber crime, your
ankle biters.
Yeah.
The ones that are sending that are sending out, you know, random malware for you to download in phishing sites that are moderate, but still easy. You know, it's easy now to put up a good phishing site. So, you know, keeping that awareness is key.
So while you're thinking about that, I was thinking we could also add in, you know, I know the three of us were going back and forth on talking about our mission, and I think it's worthwhile kind of calling out. I know we're in episode 3. So those that are listening, thank you. We're still trying to find our way, figure out exactly where we're going with everything. But, you know, as we talked through this, one of our goals is to be a bridge between those inside and outside the information security community, right? To drive understanding, learning, overall pursuit of privacy, security, you know, bringing it from home to the enterprise, making it relatable to everybody so that we're not going deep into the technical, although, you know, I think we each still love to do that and can do that pretty easily, but also not going so high level that it's not applicable to anything. So trying to find that happy medium ground, and Dan, to what you've mentioned before, creating that 360 conversation, taking both sides of an argument, whether we agree or disagree, at least exploring all angles to a conversation. So that in a nutshell is kind of our goal and where we're going. Hopefully we can continue to execute on that.
Yeah. So now back to the other topic. Another perspective, though, you know, you talk about defending, and for so long, security has been about defend. But in reality, I'm taking a much stronger position lately, over the past 4 or 5 years, on respond. Back to support. Then for reference, the third piece is business. What is it that security is trying to support? But I think the perspective of respond is increasingly important. Once we get past the idea of defend, and I'm not saying we take down the defenses, but I'm saying we don't put quite so many eggs into the block at all costs venue, that we put more time into a good response, a planned response, a conscious response, asking difficult questions before the thing happens. And having the understanding of the tech we'd want to use. But tech does not solve these problems. Tech alone does not solve these problems. Tech plus good understanding of the business at hand, open conversations with the parts of the organization that have componentry that could be attacked. And on the personal side, having good backups, understand and know who you'd call if you think you clicked on something. You know, if you are a home user, maybe you call your own IT staff for the company or institution you're part of, or you call a friend that you know has security or technology experience. But having that kind of preparatory work is more important than ever, because the people that are getting into, or the entities that are getting into our systems, that are taking information, that are being these bad actors, are more and more sophisticated. And it is not a question of if, it's a question of when. And on the personal side, how you're able to respond may result in not having to spend money to undo a ransom. It may result in being able to have the photos that you took of your kids when they were young and scanned in and got rid of the originals, or the photos you've been taking digitally. You know, there's nothing that scares me more than the fact that the last 15 years of my life, I haven't shot film at all. I don't have a film to go back to. I have a box out there that is all the stuff I've been scanning that from, you know, age zero, when I got my first disc camera. Remember those disc cameras? By the way, very hard to scan those in. The little horrible circles of very small grainy pictures. All the way through until just before my son was born. And we started moving to all digital. And you realize that the ultimate backup, which is a piece of film to come and re-go and get back to, or a physical photo, it's not there. And so this, you know, this has as much a personal impact as it does an organizational one. And then, you know, if you're in an institution, this is so much of how you are perceived by your customers, so much of how you are perceived by the market is dictated, or will be dictated, by how you respond when an incident comes up. Right? Your name is going to be in the press. Your company's name is going to be in the press. What comes after the words "Company X was attacked"? That's the ball game these days. Customer perception, client perception, user perception is dictated on those kinds of things. The same thing comes from the boards.
To bring it back to what you were originally talking about, that's a component of support, right? If you think about it, the way you respond to something is the way you are supporting your constituents, your customers, that base.
Yeah, it's you know what, you're absolutely right, and it takes it from offensive to defensive.
Right. See, I'm going to ask a question, and I don't work for the enterprise. So, what do you think the enterprise cares more about? The trust factor that they just got slammed inside the paper, and it said, you know, Company X gets hit by, or do they care that it hit the paper and the share price went down? What does the board care more about? The culture and view of the company, or the fact that their share price just got slammed?
That is a loaded question. It's so dependent on the organization we're talking
depends.
About. Yeah, it does. It does depend. Because there's a lot of organizations out there. I mean, you've got some that are going to care about share price. You've got some that are going to care about the regulatory impact. Depending on what vertical you're in, you probably have a very different perspective on what you care about, what is most impactful to your customer and the longevity of your company.
And it also comes to how your organization thinks, whether it's tactically or strategically, about those kinds of things. If it's tactically and everything is day by day, or what have you done for me this quarter, the answer is current share price. But if it's strategically, and I apologize, I don't have the actual reference, but I recall, and I will try to find it and put it in the show notes, a set of research that looked at share price, long-term share price of companies that were compromised, companies that had attacks, had some kind of a security incident. And then over the long haul, they were not only able to recover their share price, but grow at a faster rate.
Yep.
And this is my recollection, so apologize if I'm misquoting the study. I'm going to try to find it, and I will try to attach it into the show notes. But this is one of those cases where, if you take a strategic view of some of this stuff, you have a thing, you deal with it well, and you come out the other end over the long run actually building trust. And In the long run, you've actually matured your program. Organizations that have incidents mature their program, mature their whole technology stack infinitely faster than those that don't. So is it a good thing in the long run? I don't know. I'm not willing to say that it is. but if you look at it strategically, it's a whole different bent.
We got to be careful not advocating to create a breach to create longevity in a customer just to move the bike higher over the long haul.
I can tell you that it wouldn't be the first time in history that somebody somewhere has had an attack or made and said, you know what? This is a good thing. It's not a good thing in the short term, but over the long term, you can take silver linings out of everything. And if you do, then it was an attack that meant something, and it was something that made you better.
I think it comes also down to leadership too. Like you were saying, who you have at the helm, cause how they respond to it. Right. And how they support their business unit or their enterprise also will dictate how people then respond internally, you know, and how they, you know, call for action. Right. There's a cool book called Extreme Leadership. Mm-hmm. It was written by some Navy SEALs, but it's funny because you read other books like we've talked about before, like Leaders Eat Last. You can put a bunch of them together and the story notes or the points that they make in it, the way they do it is still similar to all the points everybody else makes about the idea of empathy and this and that. And taking ownership for your own mistakes, right? How do you set those things aside? So I know when we were having the conversation about when it comes to a leader and the decisions they make or how they make those decisions, or when you said sometimes fundamentally the people fall into embracing old technology because it's all they've ever known and they haven't learned something new. And that can set up everybody for failure in the long run. And if they're not willing to accept that that was their failure, unless they're removed, they're always going to be the issue.
Right. Yeah. No, I'll vouch for that book. So it was Extreme Ownership.
Oh, Extreme Ownership. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That book, they've actually written a couple of books. Phenomenal. Absolutely. Absolutely love those books. But that's true that it really does come to leadership and owning and leading by example and watching that. Really, I think what it boils down to then is culture, right? What kind of culture do you create? And we've seen this play out with some of the breaches. Do you create a culture of transparency, openness, and we want to do what's right and build a relationship with our customers? Or are we building a culture of cover up, blame, and no, this wasn't us. And we'll just give you what we think you want to hear as opposed to the actual truth. If you look at the companies that are in the latter part of that, I don't think they fit into the study that they have longevity, because I think the mass public realizes, hey, you couldn't be honest with me on this one. I don't know if I can trust you going forward.
Yeah. And some of the points they make in that book too, they take great examples from manufacturing, from sales guys, et cetera. So if you send an email to another coworker and say, hey, I need you to send me this, right? Or you send it to your boss and say, hey, I need you to send me X, but you don't explain why you need it, why you're asking for it, where you're going to send it to. He's probably going to respond back and ask why, right? So instead of putting in a few notes to explain why, what you're doing to build trust of this is why I need the document, you just sent something real quick on the fly. He comes back and asks why. You go back and say, because I need it for this, but you don't put any more in there because now you're kind of upset that he asked why. And before right. you know it, you've spent 2 hours on back and forth instead of 10 minutes clearly stating why you needed it and what you're doing to try to support the business unit. And it's right. that level of transparency, like when they were talking about a sales unit, you know, you put these new models in place for these guys to hit their metrics, et cetera, but you don't explain it, right? And as soon as they see it, they're like, oh, management's just taking away stuff from us right now. But what you didn't explain was how you were actually setting it up so either A, they could make more money, or how you were weeding out the ones you didn't want there anymore, giving more share to the others that you wanted to keep, right? And without explaining that and having a little bit of transparency, you lose the trust. And when you lose the trust between this level and this level, work starts to slow down. And now they're actually not even hitting any of their numbers, right?
Right.
I just thought that great book, going back to the idea when you're talking about leadership.
Yeah. And I mean, taking the ownership model to back to information security kind of more specifically and building that into companies. You know, I think it's very easy from our perspective that we say every company needs to be focused on information security. That's our perspective, right? But I think, you know, and Dan, you've kind of brought up this question that as you have new companies spinning up, you know, whether you're a builder or widget maker, online retail, social media mogul, you know, whatever you're in, do you focus on market first, or do you focus on building in some of those controls and information security into to the product before you go live? Because it changes the timeline, right?
Absolutely. The idea of bootstrapping and getting something out on the market quickly and seeing if it floats. People do a lot, you know, entrepreneurs do a lot of test balloons. Hey, let's, you know, we'll spend a little time getting this out there and put it out there and see where it goes. But we won't necessarily put the security in to start. We'll catch that up later. We'll fix it in post. But there's, and so that's been the prevailing mechanism for a long time. Let's put some features out there. Let's focus on features. Let's focus on getting to MVP, minimum viable product, and launch, and then see where it goes. And then when we get the revenue, we'll turn around and fix it. Well, the other side of that story is that now increasingly people are looking to security. They're looking to products to have the security built into it from the get-go, and investors are increasingly using it as a litmus test to define the price that they're willing to pay or the valuation that they're putting into companies. Right. So there's two sides to this story. One is pay me now, or short-term pain for long-term gain. And the other one is short-term gain, but could result in long-term pain if you don't put the security in. It costs a lot more to do later. I guess, like, why don't we take a couple of minutes and just sort of debate both sides of it? Which side do you want, Eric?
I see eye to eye with the, I'll call it speed to income, right? A company needs to get fast to market because at the end, you look at a startup, you have a cash infusion, right? And then you've got a burn rate. You are burning through cash because you have nothing tangible to put on the market to make any money. And your calculation is, I got to get something out there by this point. Otherwise, we have no money. And at that point, it doesn't matter if you have security or not. You are no longer a company unless you can get another cash infusion. You know, that's only sustainable for so long. So I totally get the draw that if you don't get something out there, you're taking a bit of a gamble, right? You're taking a gamble up front that is my product going to be successful in the market? And that's the entrepreneurial spirit of America and what we do, right? And giving people that option. But nowadays, you're also taking a little bit of a gamble on, am I going to create a security concern? Is it going to get attacked? Is there going to be a breakdown? Am I going to get negative press on that side? Seeing it from an entrepreneurial side, I think it's worth taking that risk because the return that if you hit mainstream market and it all of a sudden takes off, you know, I think that you can somewhat go back and build in some of those controls retroactively, although it be at a little bit higher cost. I do agree with you there, Dan. But if my product takes off, I have a lot more cash to throw back at those problems. So maybe I don't care about the incremental cost. The focus is on getting it out there first.
But something like a user experience, a UI, is very rarely left till later. It's very pretty. It's, you know, the products that come out, they spend time making it look good. It makes people want to use it. But why not security at the same time? Then, you know, the idea that that beauty is only skin deep is even more pervasive if you spend time just making it look good, lipstick on the front of it, but the back end of it is perhaps rotten underneath. You know, they may do the functions that it says it does, but you get people trusting in you, and then you have to go back if you have an issue, or you have to go back and fix it. It does impact the value UI and perception. Oh yeah, right. Exactly.
and that's a fair point. But let's look historically at
hysterically.
Hysterically, it is hysterical. Actually, security has always been the department of what? One word. No. Don't do that. Right. It's the degradation of UI. Oh well, you can't show this. Well, you can't do this. But that's what security has been predicated on for so long. And if you're focused on that UI, the UX, and getting that out to the consumer, if you introduce too much security into it, if you have the wrong person pushing the controls, you may never get your product launched and may die on the vine.
So I was actually hoping you would take the other side. you know, me being at a startup security company, like, oh, throw it all out there and we're going to make money. And you'd be like, you are the rotten person. You are the reason we have issues. So it's funny that you took the other side. And when I joined, so coming from a long automotive career, you don't throw anything into the market. You spend a long time slowly building in the quality and the testing and everything else. And when I took the chance to join the company I work for now, they were still considered a startup, but I definitely didn't hire in when, you know, 3-4 years ago, when the guys who really hired in were the ones really taking the chance. They were the ones that were out there helping build the name and explain, taking all that information they were getting from customers and taking it back to the development team, right? In the time since then till now, we can look at the playing field and say the number of companies that started the same time as we did, there were only a handful that actually made it out to where we're at now. So, you know, bravo. But I didn't understand the idea of going to a startup, like in terms of people were like, oh, so you're going to get stock. Oh, that's awesome. Right? Like if you guys end up being successful, you're going to do great. And I was like, I was looking at this from the framework, and the more every time I went into a reseller or anyone I talked to, they're like, wow, you know, you joined the company at a good time. And I'm like, what do you mean? They're like, well, I mean, you guys just went through another round of funding. I'm sitting back. I don't even understand all the rounds of funding, why that's important. I looked at the technology. I was in automotive. What we were doing with AI, autonomy, electrification, this sounded cool. So I joined. But then you get in and you start to compete against other people that are also startups. And one of the things I learned early on was they said, Brian, be careful on your narrative. Because remember, you were them 3 years ago. You know, you can't go in there and say, well, I'd be worried about them. They're a startup. What do you mean? You were a startup too. You just came, like, they could be you, right? And you're like, right, you're right. They absolutely could be. And then you kind of have to take a step back and think about, am I slamming them for being a startup? Because that was used against us by all the big players. And we're still technically a startup. Granted, we've hit that valuation point where they say, well, you're above that. Well, our competitors don't say that. They still use that against you. It's very different than the previous vertical I was in. So when you say like, oh, run in and get that product out and get money back in, I would look at all the companies that did that the same time we came out and threw their product out right away. I'd say 90% of them don't exist anymore.
But those that were more cautious and built quality from the get-go and released when it was quote unquote ready, were have a greater chance of success by your observations?
I would say by my observation, you have a greater chance of success. Because when you get in with one or two customers out the gate and their experience is good, not great, and they can take their feedback to you. And it's like the conversation we had about some of the different video systems that are out there that are being used for video conferencing. If you can go back and show that you're taking action on all the points they say, and they see that. So instead of it being like, well, hey, 6 months from now, when we do an update, you'll see that feature come on. They're seeing those features or those things added in, or we're telling them about bugs right away. Like, hey, you're right. There was a bug in that agent. Here's the fix for that. And I'm not saying that we have bugs in our agents. I was just saying that if there was a company that did that, it would show well, and it goes to building trust. So it goes right back to what we were talking about, build trust. Because if you come out and you fly by the seat of your pants, get the product out there, launch and say, we're going to fix it later. We need cash infusion now.
But if you do that, it's important to bring this back around to the support and response piece of the discussion we had. One of said video vendors took a situation and they responded admirably. They went and said, we understand we have a problem. We're stopping features. We're focusing on nothing but this, on nothing but the security components and the privacy components. And here's what we're going to do. And you know what? They're hitting. And like I think this came up in a previous discussion that the three of us had. They're rebuilding that trust. The question, though, in my mind is, over the long term, in 1 year, will that same mindset still be in place? Or have they evolved the reactive mindset, but good reactive, or have they evolved to build the security in as they go.
And I'm going to take that example as a win for my corner in my position here, right? Because if you look at it, they were retroactive. They got something that worked. It was friction-free. We got it out there. It was adopted. People grabbed onto it. And then they came back later and said, all right, now we'll add on some additional security controls.
But I'll counter that. I'll counter that with, how many times does that really happen? That case is, the reason we keep talking about it is because it's so rare.
Right.
It's not the norm. The norm is I put out software and then I lament over the next 5 years. I put out a product and then I lament over the next 5 years about how I balance new features with fixing the things that I didn't do right to start, or that I skipped on to get it out to market.
Here, let me throw this to Eric, because this goes back to two books.
I'm the hot seat.
Yeah. So you said the get it to market, fix it later. And I'm paraphrasing, so it's not exactly how you said it. But right. The idea that it's important to get it to market faster, right? You're the startup. You just got one cash infusion. Your burn rate is high. You're the engineer and you know that there's some issues with it, but you've sat in some of these meetings and you also know that the viability of the company is there. So you're not sure to say anything. So you don't. They pushed the product out because you were his boss and he was afraid to say something because there was a little bit of dopamine driven management there, and boom, the product goes out and there's issues. It comes back to the engineer. Does his boss take extreme ownership of the situation? Do they mend it? But you look at those situations in companies, people are scared, right? You're at a startup, you're seeing the burn rate, and do I say something, do I not? And you get the product out there and something bad happens, right? And
right.
And I guess it depends on what level of bad we're talking about.
It's almost an ethical conundrum at that point. The engineer that stays silent about something they know, right? And I'm not advocating silence on behalf of the engineer. You know something's wrong, it should be voiced in a collective decision on go, no go, right? I mean, that's got to be a critical junction, whether you got to go fast to market or not, right? If it's going to fail and burn, then you're playing a lose-lose game. Don't do that. That doesn't make any sense. But I don't think so. Back to what you were saying before on comparative companies that didn't put in the time to create a quality product before they went out, I don't know if security always plays into creating that quality product, right? I think it can run alongside, it can help protect that quality product, but I'm not advocating on skimping on creating the quality. If you miss on that, then it doesn't, if you go to market with a piece of garbage, let's be honest, it's just because you made it to the market doesn't mean it's going to succeed. Quality first, but I think, you know, on MVP, I think you can go MVP with security. That it's not great security, but it might get you just good enough. It becomes kind of a base that if this succeeds and we get it out there and it runs, has a run rate, and we get returns on it, we can come back. All right, now we'll build onto that little security platform. But I think if you take too much time up front, that you'll burn time trying to build in too many security controls and you just won't get a product out.
Are you advocating for balance?
Might be.
I'm shocked by this. Go ahead, Brian.
Dan, I was going to pivot then and say, okay, if Eric was talking about startups, why don't we take companies that went from startup to being big companies, the Intels, the Microsofts, the everybody else. So now, Dan, in your opinion, when you look at the size of some of the companies out there now, and they have market share, they are publicly traded companies, they're newer faces than when you look at some of the legacy automotive companies like GM, Ford, Chrysler, Honda, Toyota. Those companies had lessons learned. And where I'm going to this is with when it comes to warranty, right? There was a time and place in automotive when you looked at warranty and you ran the numbers and you said, does it really make sense to recall this? No. Even if there was a few...
The fix versus lawsuit cost.
Yeah. At the end of the day...
Well, it's also the compliance versus just pay the fine cost.
Right.
You know, it's not limited to just one market.
Yeah, you got to break a few eggs to make an omelet. So we broke a few eggs. No big deal. You look at the cost factor there. I have to look at some of the large tech companies and say that when you were saying that, well, it's important to get to market, right? You're burning through cash, but do it with a quality product, right? Try to leverage this and go at it in that realm. And I think some of it comes from looking at lessons learned, right? You look mm-hmm. up at, well, how are these guys successful? Well, now when they're looking at their success and they're learning from their issues, like when they have a vulnerability or anything else, when do I report this? Is it going to scare the market because we just released a new product? We can't take sales away from this. We already said we're going to be shipping 5 million units. We say something about our operating system, it might draw people to scare, and we only ship 4. We'd miss our number. Here's what we'll do. We'll put it as a patch next month, and we'll tie in 5 great things that we can talk about. Let's do it then. I'm not saying that happens.
In a take out the trash kind of thing. Let's bury the bad stuff, but focus on the good stuff.
It's yeah. feature padding.
And yeah. automotive companies don't have that advantage of saying, well, hey, at this minor model, we'll go ahead and tell you we're going to fix this brake pedal issue, but we went ahead and upgraded your radio. Just doesn't happen.
Right.
But in the tech space, it's very easy to do exactly that. So,
and in the continuous life cycle, the ongoing life cycle of tech, it's a lot easier to do that too. You have, you know, new features are changing on a daily, weekly, monthly basis as you're shrinking sprint times, as you're shrinking the, you know, the product development cycle. But yeah, I think but I think in those cases, it's even more endemic that if you're doing small work, you have the ability to put security into that thought process as it's happening. And it's just it's a micro addition to a set of work. Also, you start to get to, you know, as it almost becomes Frankenstein-y. And I've noticed this about modern, you know, some of the modern tech development is you have a base that started out and then they bolt on something over here, bolt on something over here, and bolt on something over here. And they're kind of disjointed. But there's very rarely a look at the whole piece going back. It's almost like if you bring it back to code reviews, to, you know, developers that are working or code development lifecycle, developers are often working in one piece of a very large code base without thinking about what they do from a security perspective in the context of the bigger of the whole code base. Something they do right here may have inadvertent implications elsewhere, which is why it's increasingly important as you work on very small sprints, very small feature releases that happen very frequently, that you need somebody somewhere, something to be looking at the whole picture from a security perspective. The break, you know, break things and you know, do great. What's the actual phrase? I've messed it up over the years, but you know, release lots of things and break them. Zuckerberg's. Zuckerberg's mantra.
I know exactly what you're saying.
I'm not a big fan of it because I think it basically endorses the idea of put stuff out there, see if it floats, and then we'll clean up the messes later. And yeah, there's somewhere between that and the world of no that is the right balance. And there's one other component I want to bring into this, and we talked about culture earlier. So much of this is rooted in the culture of the leadership of the organization. Brian, back to your question about, you know, would you rather do, you know, pay me now or pay me later? I'm going to disappoint you earlier. I'm going to disappoint you later, one way or the other. And some of this comes to culture in companies and tech and of leaderships. And you talked about engineers not wanting to raise things. And there was actually some really good research. And I Forrester, if you're a Forrester client, I recommend a piece that just came out from Heidi Shea and Jinan Budge called Don't Reward the Brilliant Jerk. Security has a really big problem with toxic culture. Not that mm-hmm. all organizations and all parts of the organizations don't have problems with toxic culture. But everything I've read in this, and I'll put the link to the blog post in the show notes. I think you have to be a client in order to get the full research. But even in the blog post, there's a list of things that can be done to try to remove or insists on removing the kind of leadership that encourages engineers to not say something that, you know, because you've got somebody at the top or somebody in along the chain that is brilliant, is bright, but chills all those kinds of discussions that you don't want to have part of it. And I think it's part of a bigger discussion around culture that has to happen to encourage people to say things.
Right. Yeah, I agree with you there. And I think some of it comes down to, let's be honest, at the end of the day, information security people are business risk leaders. Right? We're focused on the business and addressing risk. But I think so many security practitioners are still focused on, instead of realizing we have four answers to risk, four things we can do, right? And they focus on one. And that's, well, I want to eliminate the risk. That's right. What slows down productivity. Well, you can't have that. There's three other things to go along with it, right? You can reduce the risk. You can accept the risk. You can transfer the risk. And I think that comes back to, you have to have a balance of understanding those different paths in the playbook in order to support something that is agile and moving, you know, back to getting to market quicker.
So if you were to give any advice then to your children, you know, they're graduating college and they got an engineering degree, maybe it was computer science, maybe it was even mechanical, who knows, maybe it was chemical, but they have an opportunity to join a startup security company. Do you tell them, absolutely, that's the red hot thing to do? Or do you say, be cautious, feel out what their product is, what their management's doing? Because I now that I'm here in this industry, like, you hear the conversations between different people, and they're just like, oh, well, all you got to do is get in with any company. And once you're in, you can just move about and go wherever you want. And I look at everyone's resumes and it's like, 1 year here, 2 years there, 1 year there, 2 years there, 1 year there. There really isn't a sense of any loyalty that I see. Right.
But what you said was true, though. They do move. You can move anywhere, and they do. And but the tenures are not very long or very meaningful necessarily.
Right.
Yeah.
So to answer your question, I wouldn't say join any company. Right. You know, one of my favorite books is True North. I don't know if you guys have ever read that, but it comes down to understanding who you are and ethically defining yourself. Don't waver on that. Once you define who you are, and if a startup, if any company doesn't align with those practices, run, go somewhere else. There's a big enough job market. You can find something else, because if you force yourself to start bending those ethics, it's not going to play out well in the long run. It's going to drag you down or change you in a direction that you're not comfortable going. You have to hold true to who you are.
I totally agree. And this was something that I think I learned later in my career than I think that people coming out of school now will come to that realization on.
You know, right.
It's a far more accelerated time to realization of that than there was, you know, than it was all those decades ago. So my recommendation would be similar. You know, if you can go into business for yourself, be your own guidance, but there's a lot of pitfalls along the way. Be ready to deal with them. Because the reason that many people would go and stay at a large, steadfast organization was the other kind of security, you know, job security and stability. But those aren't there either anymore. Nobody is immune to the kind of flux that's all over the place. So, you know, find a place that meets your ethics. But you can't always tell that at the surface.
True. You know,
part of the startup culture, part of building a business is building a message. And there are people who are extremely good at selling a message, but may not be backing that message with reality.
Right. But I think you can couple it with be prepared, right? Be prepared to voice your views in a calm, articulate manner. And when you run into those, you know, I'll quote another book, those crucial conversations, when you come into those, have those conversations. And if they don't align, be prepared to leave. You have to be prepared to walk away, because you have to stay true to who you are. And so much of that, I mean, comes bringing it back into just information security in general. is key. I mean, if you look at it, I think that ethics is the key thing that differentiates the those that are attacking and those that are defending, right? That's ethics are huge, you know, and, you know, anybody who might be listening from a company that maybe doesn't have an information security background, but is going to hire somebody, you have to understand, and I don't know how to tease this out in questions or whatnot, but if you have an information security person that is unethical, it's just not going to work. Because if you think about it, the skills that most of us have, the ability to look at critical information, sensitive information across the organization, you can make it look like it's anybody else that's looking at that. And what stops good information security people from doing those things is ethics.
So trust no one, even your security person, to play the other side of the coin?
Trust only your security person. Choose wisely.
Or trust but verify, really. Put some checksums in place that are outside of security to help make sure that even your security program or the practitioner or the leader that is running that is doing so in a way that aligns with the rest of the 100%. Organization.
Well, it's back to, right, you could have the most technical savant, but if it doesn't align with business ethics and all that, cut ties.
So I got another one then for both of you. Being that you've had experience either A, still working for a very large enterprise or worked for a large enterprise and now have a private practice. Talking about startups, at what point, if you're in a position in security to purchase a product, do you say, well, this startup to me is too young? I really like their product, but I'm not willing to take the risk because I don't have the appetite for that level of risk. Or from a budget side, this looks good. They're talking about doing the same stuff that this guy's doing. It might take a year to get there, but I can get it for a quarter of the price.
I think that's inversely proportional to the size and bureaucracy of the institution that is doing the buying. Large established organizations are very risk averse and they want stability. The same kind of thing we talked about in the employment side. They will gravitate toward large established suppliers. The two people in a garage mindset, it doesn't fly well. And I've had those kinds of discussions at places I've been, and you end up paying more for an established product that may or may not be the same. But as you go to small, as you get more nimble and more cost conscious and a little more risk taking, back to the question of do I put something out without having all of the security componentry in place, you're taking some risk there. You make the same kind of decision when you're buying, but you also get the opportunity. The rewards are potentially enormous. Getting in early on a company, on a product set, helping them shape it, and doing so at potentially lower cost.
And that's so using Sun
Tzu. Or potentially having it all nuke itself on you and you're left without anything. It's a calculated risk.
Yeah.
It's almost like the conversation on playing penny stocks versus blue chip stocks, right?
Right. Well, I was going to sell you there and just say, okay, now I already know your organization. I do know that 2 years ago you did buy a product from a company that was very new and you actually helped shape their product for them, but it wasn't necessarily a security product. It was more a tool, but you were really happy with what you got. Now they've grown and you actually sit on their advisory board now. And I come in knowing that, and I don't bring them up.
I say, an alternative vendor?
Yeah, not to them, but I'm offering now a security solution, not really the type of tool you were using over here. There could be a little more risk for you, but I'm going to give you an opportunity to come in. We want you to help shape the direction of the product. Here's what our roadmap is. You tell me the number 1, 2, and 3 item on here, and we'll make sure that in the next 6 months, you're getting those features. So as I'm rolling out over the next 3 months, you know that in 6 months from now, this is what you're getting. And I'm doing it at this price.
Yeah. I think this comes back to, and I mentioned this before, crossing the chasm, right? And understanding who you're marketing to, and to Dan's point, there's different companies that can take on different risk appetites. But I think one of the things that startups can do to help span that gap is what you mentioned, Brian, the advisory board. pull in from some prominent people from the community to help shape it up front and start to become a vocal point for that company. Because and let's be honest, if a startup comes in, you know, Brian, you bring me a product and it's just you, granted, I trust you. I don't know if I'm gonna bite on it though. But if all of a sudden you bring me that same product and hey, we've got Dan Ayala as an advisor and he's been, you know, helping us mold this, it's a different story at that point. But I think startups can tap into the security community, and instead of trying to go after a company and bring in the company associated with the person, just bring in the person on a personal level and use their expertise to help sculpt, help build the product to a direction. And then you can start using that to make the introductions to some of the enterprise customers.
This isn't limited to just startups. I think this kind of mindset can be taken on by any organization or any entity that may not be able to hire all those types of people in right away or to build the cachet without to build the confidence. You know, even I was talking with somebody about, you know, security people, we tend not to want to be quiet about the things we do. School districts, K-12 school districts have technology programs, but they very rarely have security or privacy professionals on staff. But think about the trove of information that's related to the students there, and at ages that they can't necessarily protect themselves.
Right.
As a community, should we be volunteering, or should those organizations be reaching out to the security and privacy community to engage us, to help them? Because I guarantee you will find lots of willing participants, especially if their kids are part of that district. I'd be elated to help the local district.
It's a resounding yes. I think if you look at that, you know, I'm not saying this is unique to the information security community, but if you, by and large, if you look at a lot of our peers, love to give back. And I would love to have the opportunity to just tell the message and help others. I mean, heck, we started a podcast, right? That's what we're doing. The idea is, hey, we have a lot of knowledge collectively. Let's give some of it back and let's transition it from the highly technical that we've always known and putting into to real world context to help shape the future of where we're going.
And that's where I was looking at what Wiser was doing when we were having that conversation. You have a group of security professionals that are figuring out how to help give back, but to educate, right? And if there was a startup company out there that said, hey, I have a product that could be used to help educate. And this goes back to, there's companies out there that create specific education tools that have nothing to do with security tools. But if there was educational tools that could be used for security, here's a scary fact for you that I was just reading about. And it had to do with the whole work from home and children being home now. And you look at the predators that are out there online and the age groups that they target. You take all these children now out of the classroom where a teacher can't visually look at them to see that there's been any physical harm or this going on, or a child's crying or is emotional, right? And now you put them in the home, right? Or they're stuck at the home. And now the other individual that might've been the predator is stuck at home. And even he, it's like a caged cat, you know, a lion. And I know that sounds bad, but that's the reality. And now they're seeing this increase online of bad pictures. I don't want to get into the detail, right? But I think what people don't know in terms of the consumer side out there, just the average person outside of security, is that, and I'm stealing this quote from an article I just read, but that there's a sixth ocean out there, right? It's the data ocean. And it's actually kept in worse shape than any of our existing oceans. And we dump crud into it all the time. And it's just filling and filling and filling with data, right? But that data people can use, and they can use it against you, and they can gather it, and people shove all sorts of bad stuff in it. And nobody really cares that every time they get online, they're creating data that goes in there. Every time you pull something up and you look at it, maybe you did click on a picture you didn't mean to do. But if we can say, like, yes, if there's a startup company out there, you know, go to market fast, you still have to put quality into it. But would you go to a startup company that you knew their finished product was just as an educational tool and you knew it wasn't going to make a lot of money, but it was going to help shape the future and protect this ocean of data and all the consumers and our children that are going to grow up swimming in it? You know, like, I try to explain this to my own son that there's this, you know, hey, you've been on your phone for a while. What were you looking at? I go, did you know that you just created a pond in our house? And he's like, a pond. I'm like, every time you look something up, you've added more data to this little lake in our house. And that I try to explain this as an ocean, right? Like using this as a way for him to picture it, you know? And he's like, I go, just take the number of people in the world. And every time I go, how much user time did you have or FaceTime on your phone did you have today? And he says the number. I go, could you imagine all the data that you just stored in our house? Right? Like, and it's trying to paint a picture for the youth to understand why that could be a risk, right?
That is a great analogy.
It is a great analogy. And I'll follow it up to close us out with one more analogy, in that water will always find its way out or in. So be wary. Thank you, everybody, for listening. That wraps up this episode. And thank you, Brian and Eric. It's been another great debate. Look forward to doing it again next time. Thanks so much for joining us.